Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Doing good, Justin.
Real quick, I'm going to the True Crime Podcast Festival.
And this is in Chicago?
Yes, this is Chicago, Saturday, July 13th at the Marriott downtown. There will be 80 True Crime podcasts there. The Vanished, Crime Writers On, Court Junkie, The Fall Line, True Crime Obsessed, Missing More Murray, and Moi. It's all day Saturday. So it gives you a chance to meet all your favorite podcasts. There's going to be a large-scale meet and greet with several panel discussions and live episodes. Maybe I need to sign up for a live episode. I don't know. That would be weird. Head out to truecrimepodcastfestival.com or look for them on social media. I will see you there.
And for those who keep asking, where's our extra content? Join our fan club. It's out at patreon.com/generationY. Get extra episodes, minisodes, and whatever other content we put on there for you.
You'll actually hear Aaron and I have a bit of an argument out there. Oh, teaser.
We did a follow-up to a recent Patreon episode. And yeah, we get a little heated there, but it just goes to show that we're not carbon copies of one another, Justin.
No, and we don't even argue, really. It was just a heated topic. So that's all.
Or maybe not. You'll have to listen to find out.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the best-selling true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Tonight's case might be a wrongful conviction case. Got a lot of twists and turns, and I will admit that I came in very biased against the accused when researching this. So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Well, I have to say, I don't know that I was biased in this case because this case is fascinating me for a long time. It's the case of Barry Beach, and he was accused of the murder of a 17-year-old friend of his named Kimberly Neese. This took place June 15th, 1979 in Poplar, Montana. Justin, let's start with some background on Barry Beach.
His parents were divorced. His father moved to Louisiana. Barry wasn't very close with his father because of the distance, and his mother remarried. He was an honor student for most of high school, and he actually lived very close to Kimberly.
Actually, both of Barry's parents remarried. She would end up encouraging him to go and visit his father. I don't know. It's one of those things, I think, where his mother was looking to get him closer to his dad. Like, I know your dad's gone, but you really should get to know him. I think she meant well. You said how he lived not too far from Kimberly Neese, and Kimberly Neese lived just doors down from Barry Beach. Her father, Ted, served on the town council, and Kimberly also had a sister named Pam. She was younger. And at some point, Pam and Barry had actually dated. Kimberly was a cheerleader. When she graduated high school, she was the class valedictorian. She graduated with honors in June of 1979.
It was on June 15th, 1979, that she was out with her boyfriend, Greg Norgard, and they went to a drive-in movie. It said that they fought, got into an argument, and she returned home after the movie at around midnight. She took her father's pickup truck out for a drive to the local gas station convenience store. Lots of kids would hang out at this place, so sort of a meeting point, I think.
Yeah, her sister Pam was waiting for her, I think, because her parents would often say, you need to take your sister. You can't leave her home alone. They were only about a year apart. At this point where Pam said, yeah, she just left without me. So she just took off. This was about 15 minutes after she had returned home from the movie. Maybe it was because she wasn't in a good mood and probably didn't want to end the night that way. So she went out probably looking to see if there were any friends out.
Kimberly would not return home this night. At 7 a.m. in the morning, June 16th, 1979, two Fort Peck tribal police found her father's truck along the Poplar River. It was on the southwest edge. The area was known as a hangout for teens. So obviously the convenience store she'd gone to was a hangout, and witnesses actually saw her there. It's possible that she picked some people up or went to go meet some more people at this other spot. These two officers looked inside the truck. They saw blood in the cab. It was on the outside. And on the ground were distinctive drag marks that went all the way to the river. They followed footprints and drag marks and ended up finding the body of Kimberly Neese. She was face up about 250 feet from the pickup truck. The truck was locked. the keys were missing. The investigators found lots of evidence at this crime scene, didn't they, Aaron?
They found, as you described, blood inside and outside the truck. Most of it inside the truck was primarily located on the passenger seat and on the dash on that side of the vehicle. There was bits of blood and hair on the steering wheel. There was urine found. Also, there was a bloody handprint on the passenger door, as if someone had slammed it shut. There were also dozens of fingerprints found all over inside that passenger side area of the truck. They also found an article of clothing. They found Kimberly's sweater. Now, Kimberly's body was in the water face up, and I've seen a still image of it, and it's quite haunting. If you go over this evidence and you think about what it looks like, I mean, to me, it's obvious that someone had attacked her inside the truck and then dragged her out of the truck and killed her on the way to the water.
They attacked her in the truck. It appears that they drug her out through the passenger side. So we can speculate that possibly she was sitting in the passenger seat, talking to people outside of the truck when she was attacked. Maybe somebody else was driving the truck, but I think it looks more like she was sitting inside in the passenger seat when she was attacked and then pulled from the truck.
Well, and the only other way it could be is if she was inside the truck in the driver's seat, but then someone in the passenger seat started attacking her and then yanked her to that side as they were getting out, because they did find a lot of her hair outside of the truck as if it was pulled out, maybe as she was being yanked.
Now, they found two sets of shoe prints and another set of footprints, so barefoot, heading down to the river. So three people, it appears, attacked her.
Well, that's just what the evidence says.
She was bludgeoned with a crescent wrench and possibly a tire iron or multiple weapons.
Yeah, I think the crescent wrench came into play because her father owned the truck and there was a crescent wrench that was supposedly in the front of the truck, but it wasn't found. And of course, they can look at her injuries. The crescent wrench fits some of those injuries, but she was hit 20 to 30 times with at least two different blunt objects.
She had extensive fracturing and bruising. Her brain had hemorrhaged. She had defensive wounds on her hands and arms. It appeared that the attack was coming from lots of different directions. She was not sexually assaulted, and they found her purse, so she wasn't robbed either.
Her family is obviously devastated to learn about this. Pam's parents broke the news to her about her sister, and they went into action. You know, despite feeling hopeless, they really wanted to find justice for their daughter, for their sister. And so posters were made up about Kimberly. They offered a $10,000 reward for information leading to the killer or information about her murder. The family wrote letters to the local paper imploring people to come forward if they knew anything. I don't know, what more can you do than that? There was this idea, though, that someone out there knew something. This wasn't a crime that was done in secret. In fact, because of all the rumors that were starting to float around, that maybe multiple people knew what had happened and could shine a light on this, but they weren't coming forward.
Yeah, nobody suspected a stranger or somebody just passing through had done this. They felt it was somebody she knew, possibly friends of friends or another circle of students from her high school.
So there's this small community, the Fort Peck Reservation. There are a lot of Native Americans in the area. And I think it's one of the aspects of this case that caused law enforcement to have a lot of issues. It's because there are a lot of people that just didn't trust law enforcement. And Justin, when it came to this case, when it came to the collection of evidence, when it came to the crime scene, it wasn't like they had a police force there with detectives and people locking down the scenes. In fact, they had multiple agencies, tribal police, FBI, sheriff's office, on the scene with no one in charge and people just walking around, taking pictures or looking at things and basically contaminating the scene.
I think the sheriff even comes out and says the entire scene was destroyed, all of the evidence tainted, police procedure was not followed, and it's hard to derive anything from this murder scene.
So right from the get-go, when you think you have all this blood evidence, this hair evidence, fingerprint evidence, shoe print, and footprint evidence, and yet much of this really doesn't matter anymore. In fact, when you get down to it, it felt like the palm print maybe meant something, and then pretty much everything else was, you know, good luck. We don't know if it counts.
Well, and I think that they documented it enough where we can say the footprints existed, the fingerprints existed. But then when these investigators walk over the footprints or touch things, all of a sudden some of those fingerprints can't be used. All of a sudden you can't take a plaster cast of one of these footprints to compare it to something else because it's all been trampled over.
They also ended up finding a bloody towel on a fence, and they think that it was tied to this crime. But like all the rest of the evidence, they test what they can. Were they able to link it to a suspect?
No, they were not.
So this is looking like a pretty hopeless case. Now, there were many suspects. One of them was her boyfriend, Greg Norgaard, because they did have an altercation that night, an argument, and maybe he was really upset. Maybe when she went back out, he met up with her. That's a theory. But they spoke to Greg Norgaard, and, well, they just didn't think he was involved. They cleared him, basically.
Yeah, they spent very little time with him.
One of the early suspects, other than Niece's boyfriend, was an athlete at the school named Albert Gooch Kern, and he was a former All-State guard at Poplar High School. He had this, I guess, reputation for fighting and drinking. A number of people said that he tried to force his affections on younger women. This is something I found out on the MontanansForJustice.com website. There was actually a witness named Joanne Jackson, who told the FBI, one of those agencies that was on scene at the beginning, just 2 days after the murder, that someone who lived across the Poplar River from the murder scene had heard Kim Neese screaming. And what she was screaming was, "No, Gooch, no." Joanne Jackson wouldn't tell the authorities who had said that. She just said that she was told about this. And then sometime later, she told them the name of the person she heard it from. But that person denied ever saying that. It was an early suspect, but the authorities didn't think much of it because it only came from one person. And then when that person named their source, that source said, "I never said anything like that. I didn't say it."
I would just say it's not credible because it's one person. We had multiple footprints and fingerprints, so go figure. They will end up talking with Barry Beach multiple times, but they essentially clear him also. They talk to about 15 other people that are friends, acquaintances, whatnot, and they're sort of spinning their wheels here.
So let's talk about when Barry Beach was questioned. Let's talk about his alibi. He said that the day before the murder, this was June 15th, 1979, Barry had spent most of the day swimming. He was smoking marijuana, drinking beer with his friends, Shannon O'Brien and her boyfriend, near the Poplar River. And where they were swimming was pretty close to where Kimberly Neese was murdered.
Which might be coincidental because it is a hangout spot where the kids would gather. Not only did Barry admit that he was drinking and smoking pot that day, but he actually goes on to say He'd been binge drinking for several days. So.
And he had said that he had tried to get Pam Neese to go with him, but she said she didn't want to. And then he said when he was getting ready to leave, because he was ready to go home and sleep it off, he said that his car got stuck in the sand by the riverbank. And so he then had to walk back to town, got home, where he was the only person there. So there's no witness to say, yeah, he came home at this time and went to sleep.
Yeah, he'd been partying for 2 days straight and no one's home. He goes to bed. That's his alibi, which cannot be corroborated by anyone.
Now, his mother did return home later, and she said that she checked on him when she got home and that he was asleep in his bed. I guess all I can say to that is by the time she got to him, it was early the next morning. And she said he was still dressed at that time. And then on June 16th, Barry Beach went to his grandparents' Brockton, Montana ranch. It was located about 20 miles south of Poplar. And he had already planned to help them with branding their young cows that day. So it's not like this was suspicious or he was trying to get away. His mother and his sister joined him for lunch that day, and that's when he learned of Kimberly Neese's death.
His mother and sister do not report that he behaved any differently, besides just being kind of shocked that his friend was dead.
And I could believe that he would be shocked. You know, if Barry Beach didn't kill Kimberly, because they lived on the same street, when they were kids, they played together all the time. Now, I had mentioned early on that Barry's mother would encourage him to go visit his father, who lived in Monroe, Louisiana.
It's Monroe, if you're from there.
Well, Barry went to Monroe, and I think a lot of this is, you know, you don't really know your dad well enough. You should go spend some time with him. Barry's time in Monroe didn't go that well. He ended up getting a drunken driving ticket while he was there. And so he had to stay longer than he had expected because he needed to pay it off. So he needed to work, earn some money, and pay that ticket off before he could finally return to Montana, which he did in December of 1979.
He bounces back and forth between Montana and Louisiana several times to visit his father.
But that first time he goes back to Montana, detectives want to talk to Barry.
Again, about Kimberly's death.
Now, they look at him and think, you left Poplar right after the murder. And the way Barry responds to them is he answers all their questions and he talks about why he left Poplar. He goes on to give them his fingerprints, his palm prints, even his footprints, and gives them a hair sample. They had found a hair on Kimberly's clothing.
That did not belong to Kimberly.
They need hair to analyze.
Did his fingerprints match any of the ones found on the vehicle?
Well, after they took his prints, they did comparisons, and they didn't match any of the prints that they found.
How about that palm print?
His palm print did not match the palm print found on the truck.
How about the footprints?
None of these things matched. They couldn't match Barry to any of their forensic evidence. And Barry told them, he said, I don't have anything to do with this. I don't know why I would kill Kimberly. They tell him, you're not a suspect, and they release him. Later, they asked him to take a polygraph. And they said, hey, all the other people we've questioned, we've had them do that as well, so it's no big deal. He went with his mom and stepdad to go take this polygraph. I think it's because they kept telling him, you're not a suspect. We're just really trying to get information here. And this lets us know that, you know, the information you're giving us is truthful, and then we can use it.
We can clear you again.
And so he goes and takes this polygraph test and he passes it. At least that's what they tell him.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
In May of 1980, Barry received a certificate of completion for high school, but he wasn't allowed to walk at graduation because he was missing a quarter of an elective credit. Now, I don't know how this works, but I don't think this is a big deal. For most of his high school days, he was a very, very good student. It was soon after this that Barry was arrested for driving while his license was suspended. And this is due to that DUI in Louisiana. So he then had to serve a 22-day jail sentence. Then, when he was released, here come the detectives asking again to speak with him about Kimberly Neese. And this time, they talked to him for about 2 hours, and Barry answered all of their questions. And once again, they're asking him to take a polygraph. Now, he'd already taken one. Why does he have to take another one? Do they have some new compelling questions or something?
Exactly. He's actually cooperating. He's answering everything. But come on. He's now essentially being hounded for the same information and a second polygraph. I understand why he is kind of like, I'm not going to really cooperate with you, or I'm going to take off on you.
It's like they want a do-over, hoping that he'll fail this one so they can throw it back in his face and say, ha, see, you didn't pass.
And at no time does he ask for a lawyer.
Well, Barry does seem to ditch the detectives, and he heads back to Louisiana to visit his dad again. And while he's there, he's working construction and living with his dad and his stepmom. And in December of 1981, he enlisted in the Navy and was assigned to the USS Spruance in Norfolk, Virginia.
In 1982, they were supposed to set sail to the Mediterranean, but the sheriff's office sent a letter to the Navy through the FBI office, and it said that Barry was a suspect in Kimberly's murder. Two people had placed him at the scene of the crime. Okay. Two people. The Navy told Barry, get the sheriff to clear you or take an honorable discharge. If he stayed in the Navy without being cleared, he could be charged with fraudulent enlistment and possibly sent to the brig or even Leavenworth, right down the street from us. So Barry took the discharge.
And that's because when you enlist, they ask you some pretty important questions. If he was actually connected to a crime and he didn't own up to it on the enlistment questions, then he enlisted fraudulently.
But he didn't, because he didn't know he was the prime suspect. They never told him.
Yeah, they kept reassuring him that you're not a suspect. You're not a suspect.
It's kind of a bait and switch there.
But this is years later.
Yeah.
So with contaminated evidence, contaminated crime scene, multiple agencies, multiple suspects, different theories, they're settling on Barry. That's what it looks like.
So Barry leaves Norfolk, Virginia, returns to Montana, goes to the sheriff's office, says, what's up with the letter? What's up with me being a suspect? And the sheriff actually denies writing the letter, even though it's a letter written from that sheriff's office, complete with letterhead and signed by the sheriff. The sheriff says that Barry wasn't a suspect, but he doesn't offer to help Barry in any way. He doesn't offer to call the Navy and retract the letter, anything. So Barry obviously is pissed off and decides to return to Louisiana with his father. Barry's, I won't say he's a bad guy, but he's a partier, he's a drinker. So on October 31st, 1982, he's arrested for misdemeanor theft. He and a friend were caught breaking into a junkyard and siphoning gas. People actually do that. He pleaded guilty and got 63 days in jail. It was very embarrassing for his father and his family. And his father said, "You need to leave. I don't want you at my house." So Barry moved out. At the same time, he was talking to his little stepsister. She was 14, 15 years old. Talking to her about running away with a friend and hitchhiked to Texas to see her father. Barry was trying to talk her out of it and promised to call before she left. On January 4th, 1983, she called Barry and he picked her up and her friend from their school, brought the girls to his apartment, and again tried to convince them to stay. He then called his father and stepmother. When they arrived, all hell broke loose. There was a confrontation. Barry left with his sister and her friend. He returned home a few hours later, and police officers were waiting there to arrest him for contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Kind of got the shaft here.
Well, I think really all this says is that maybe his dad was a little difficult to deal with, and both he and his stepsister had issues with him. I don't think Barry or his stepsister really wanted to live there, but I think with Barry trying to talk her out of it was just more of a, you're a little young to be running off. You probably should just stick it out until you're of age to leave. Easy for him to say, but in a way you could say he's looking out for her. He probably didn't know her that well because it was his dad's wife's daughter. I mean, I think this is just a situation where Barry is, at least so far, he's looking like maybe he is a decent guy. You know, he's looking out for his stepsister. It didn't go well. It ends up with him being arrested again. But, you know, at the heart of this, it seems like he's trying to do the right thing.
Now, he ends up spending the night in jail with a $1,500 bond. The next day, officers find out that Barry was a suspect in the 1979 murder. And this is why we're even talking about this arrest and this family altercation, is because this is where the police officers, literally 4 years later, hear that he was a suspect. Now, this is in Louisiana, not Montana, but these Louisiana cops, they have some unsolved murders in their state, right?
Right. There were several murders that they had connected. They learned that Barry had actually met one of those victims before. These detectives connected him to one of the victims in their murder, unsolved murder cases. And then they learned that he was a suspect in this case from Montana. So now he's connected to two murder victims. I think they're saying, what are the odds?
Yeah, connect the dots, right? Barry is interrogated by two detectives for multiple days, and he's questioned about three different murders that went down in Louisiana. The police maintain that they were friendly and non-combative, and that Barry had nothing to hide. So Barry answered all their questions. The next day, January 7th, he's told that he's going to be released to his father. While he's waiting in the lobby, four detectives entered and began interrogating him again. They were not being very nice this day. They told him that they had fingerprints and shoe prints linking him to the scenes of the Monroe, Louisiana murders. Barry, of course, is denying all involvement and at some point is asking for an attorney. They do not grant him one. He also asked to speak to his mother over the phone.
But they denied it because, according to Barry, they told me that my mother specifically said that I was no longer her son until I talked to them and confessed to these murders. Now, we've talked about this before, but they can lie to you all day, all night long. You know, that's one thing to know that, but most people probably don't know that, right?
He's 21 years old.
What does he know about this?
He doesn't know anything.
Yeah.
They also block his father from paying his bond and releasing him from jail. with these interrogations. He's questioned on and off. They give him a voice stress test, whatever that is, and they have him sign away his Miranda rights multiple times. He was told that he failed all the tests that they gave him. He was told that they know he was involved.
Barry's somewhat of a religious guy, and one of the detectives said, "I'll pray with you." You know, anything that gets you more buddy-buddy with a detective probably sounds like a good idea, right? Or maybe he feels like praying is what he should do at this point because it's looking pretty bad. I mean, after all, he thought he was being released and now he's being interrogated. So according to Barry, God told the detective that I'd killed these girls and he wasn't going to forgive me until I confessed. And I, and remember this is Barry saying this, remember telling him that I felt that my forgiveness was a decision for God to make and not him. And he just went ballistic. So this detective flips out on Barry. They go on to threaten him with the electric chair, saying, "We can put you to death here in Louisiana, and this is what it's like to die in the electric chair." Pretty horrifying.
Yeah, they're saying, "We can nail you for these three murders and execute you." At this point, these interrogations have gone on for over 72 hours. He's not been granted an attorney. And when you're held for that long without charge, you're supposed to go in front of a judge. That's just the process down there, I guess. They don't put him in front of a judge.
But the reality of it is they're not even really trying to get Barry on these three Monroe murders. They're trying to get him on the Kimberly Niece murder.
Yeah, they pretty much pull a switcheroo on him at the last minute. Then they asked him, "Can you give us a hypothetical situation of how Kimberly was murdered with you as the perpetrator?" So that's when they started, you know, worming their way into him giving a confession, which it's questionable if he even gave that as a confession or if he was just giving them what they wanted to hear.
Because the amount of stress he's under, he's willing to say whatever it takes to get this to end. So he gives them the story about how Kimberly Niece died. And he says that he got in the truck with her and they went down to this area by the Poplar River and that he was trying to make out with her essentially and Kimberly wasn't having it. And so she started fighting him off. And so then he would hit her and he would try to kiss her some more. And I mean, to me, this sounds like an attempted rape.
Yeah, yeah. And he says he finds this crescent wrench and begins beating her with it.
After she gives him a pretty good hit into the face or something. It just gets worse from there. Now, he says that she got out of the driver's side and he got out the passenger side. And then he went around the truck and started hitting her again. I think this time, with a tire iron?
Yeah, crowbar tire iron, something he found in the bed of the truck.
And then I guess he got her on some plastic and then he dragged her down to the river and I guess threw her in.
Yeah. So this is his statement now because the interrogators are saying, "We're going to put you to death for these three murders unless you essentially confess to this other one back in Montana." And again, Barry didn't just come out and confess or anything. He was fighting them and arguing with them. But by the end of it, he knows that it's a confession and that they're documenting it and they're going to have him sign it.
But the thing was, is according to Barry, they were sort of dangling that as, "Why don't you tell us how you theoretically did it? And then we can check it against the facts and we could possibly clear you." It almost felt like, "Well, we just need you to cooperate one more time with us." I mean, I think he thinks that this is a little light at the end of the tunnel. It's not. It's a train.
Good analogy. Barry, like other people, feel that if they just tell the investigators what they want to hear, they can get out of this room and then they can fight it amongst the courts, the legal system, or they can make it all right later because they know that they're not going to talk their way out of it within the interrogation room. The problem is when you give a confession in an interrogation room, that's all they need. And there's no making it right later. So Barry even tells the investigators, "I'm going to tell you this just so I can get back to Montana and make everything right. And one of the investigators actually says, well, when you do, I'm going to help you. I'll help you clear your name back in Montana. Again, they can lie to you.
Well, that's the end of Barry Beach. He's arrested for the murder of Kimberly Neese, and he's cleared of the three Monroe murders. The trial, Justin, is about 8 months later. They extradite Barry from Louisiana to Montana. There's some contention about this extradition because he was only 17 years old when the murder was committed, but it gets straightened out. Louisiana allowed his transfer, and he pleaded not guilty, but he was placed in Montana's adult courts. This isn't, taken in as, well, he was a minor at the time. No, he's being tried as an adult. And of course, it's here he's also filing a motion with the help of his attorney to suppress that confession because, as he puts it, it was coerced.
Has been maintaining his innocence literally since he walked out of that interrogation room. Hey, I know criminals can do whatever, say whatever, but he says, man, as soon as I walked out of there, I knew I'd done the wrong thing, and I'm trying to right the situation.
They deny that motion.
When you have a confession that wasn't really given under duress, that goes in, and he's screwed.
Now, the trial started about 8 months later, but early on, he was actually offered a plea deal. All he had to do was plead guilty to mitigated homicide, and they would give him a 20-year sentence. So he could possibly get out in about 5 years, but Barry Beach says, I'm innocent, and I'm not going to plead guilty to something that I did not do. So he rejects the plea deal.
Rolls those dice.
Yeah, and you do, but we recently talked about a case where we questioned why someone would not take a plea deal. But in this case, this is a pretty serious murder. This isn't a questionable situation where you kind of have some wiggle room. No, this is, if they find you guilty, you're looking at hard time.
It's a brutal murder. Kimberly was beaten to death. It's not something that a jury or a judge is going to take lightly. They're going to throw the book at you. And he maintains his innocence. So he says, nope, I'm going to take it to trial.
He goes on to say that he felt that after having given that coerced confession, that if he had pled guilty at all, that it from then on out, he was just compounding his mistakes, and he didn't want to do that. His family ends up hiring Charles Timer Moses as his defense attorney. That's one heck of a name. The trial began on April 10th, 1984, and his attorney brought up concerns about finding an impartial jury. So he was wanting to go to another county because he thought, well, this isn't good for Barry Beach. We do it here.
Change of venue, yeah.
Prosecutor was Mark Rasko. He's very well known in Montana. He eventually became the governor. As prosecutor on this case, he centered the evidence all around the confession, obviously, because the forensic evidence couldn't be tied to Barry. So he's really saying, hey, he gave a detailed account of how he murdered Kim Neese. That's the smart approach, right, Justin?
Well, yeah, and that's all you need is a confession. You play that confession, you read that confession, you make Barry read that confession on the stand if he actually takes the stand. The jury's going to laugh at you.
So he uses this confession in court. He has one of the detectives come up and they play the role of Detective and Barry Beach, and they go through that confession so they can play it out in front of the jury. Now, Rasko has this timeline for the crime, how Barry met Kimberly at the service station in Poplar, how they then drove to a spot by the river to chat, and they smoked some pot, and then that's when Barry started making the moves on Kimberly, and she refused, and that's where the escalation happened. That's where Barry would use violence on this woman who had refused his advances. And he hit her several times, and she got out of the truck. And then he ran around the truck and tackled her and started hitting her more and more. Then he dragged her body to the river, and he threw in the murder weapon and the keys. He then burned his bloody clothing and walked home.
An interesting part of the story is he takes off his bloody clothing, burns it in a train boxcar and walks home naked,
covered in blood.
Now, given it's the middle of the night, I don't know if anyone's going to see him, but it's an interesting way to cover all the tracks here. And being that this confession is coming 4 years after the fact, it's really hard to fact check it.
Now, as I said, there was supposed to be a crescent wrench in that truck, and Kim's father testified to that fact. The prosecutor goes on to mention that there was a pubic hair found on Kimberly's sweater that belonged to Barry Beach. And I'll tell you what, Justin, that's the clincher. Because if you're a jury and you hear that this suspect has confessed, and then you hear there actually is one piece of forensic evidence that ties him to the murder, how do you not find him guilty?
Exactly. That's the only evidence that you need, is placing him at the scene.
The defense tries their best. They come out and they say, look, physical evidence cannot tie our client to this murder. You can go through all the fingerprints, blood type, footprints, hair, all of that. No connection to Barry. And then his lawyer, Moses, goes on to question the Louisiana detectives about how they interrogated Barry, their methods, how that confession may have been coerced. Barry's mother takes the stand and denies ever making any statements about her son having any blood on his clothes. Yet, with all of this, it doesn't matter because you have a confession and you have a pubic hair. This trial lasted for 3 days, and the jury took 6 hours, which is shocking, I think, to deliberate. On April 13, 1984, Barry Beach was found guilty of murdering Kimberly Neese.
He's sentenced to 100 years behind bars?
Yeah, Barry had asked for a chance at life, meaning please let me have some parole at some point. That was denied. Now, Justin, how many times we have to talk about this? But at some point, we had this Supreme Court decision that said, if you're a minor and you're involved in a crime where you're given life, well, it's just not fair. You need to be resentenced. There should have been mitigating factors because your brain has not developed enough to understand what you were doing and the repercussions that come from that. So you would think that it would apply to this case because he was given 100 years. Is that not life? When they brought him in, he was in his 20s.
Yeah, that's definitely life. But you're dealing with an adult now. It's hard to look back and consider him a child at the time of the murder. This is shocking for Barry and his family, but it gives Kimberly's family some closure because they've been waiting for justice for over 4 years.
Barry, of course, maintained his innocence. And even after being sent to prison, he started writing letters. He started filing appeals with the help of his attorneys. On July 25th, 1985, the Montana Supreme Court upheld his conviction. And they rejected that his confession was not voluntary, or that the trial should have been moved, and that he should have been tried in juvenile court. So all these arguments from Barry were thrown out. They said they just aren't important when it comes down to it.
And that's what blows me away, is this is the fight he has to make, is I falsely confessed. I should have had a change of venue. These are the technicalities. These are the things that are going to grant him a retrial. Not the inconsistencies in the investigation, not the inconsistencies in his confession, not things that are based in what us true crime fans believe would completely exonerate him or at least bring into question his guilt.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Now, there's some matter of the fact that after his confession, there was another confession, and this is in quotes, where he was with an attorney when he was speaking to the detectives. And so that's what the court was using as, hey, you had a lawyer there and you still said that you had done it, so it's on you. He filed for post-conviction relief from the Montana Supreme Court. And on February 8th, 1996, they dismissed that because they said you didn't raise the issues you brought up here within 5 years of your conviction. So these aren't new issues, and we already settled this. August 6th, 1997, his habeas corpus petition was dismissed because there was no evidence his confession was false or that he was innocent. Again, it's the same stuff. We already knocked it down. You're still bringing it up. He's getting these chances, but they don't really mean anything to the courts because there are already prior decisions that were made. They can easily bat these things away. Middle of 1999, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upholds all the previous dismissals, and Barry was out of appeals at that point. Now, it's in 2000 when Barry gets a glimmer of hope because Centurion Ministries begins working on his case. They're based in New Jersey. They're an innocence group, and they have freed at that point about 40 wrongfully convicted inmates between the years of 1983 and 2007. It's no surprise that after they looked over all of the evidence in the case, they decided that Barry Beach was innocent of this crime. And they found that it was compelling enough that they enlisted the help of a Seattle-based attorney named Peter Camiel. In 2005, Barry asked that the pubic hair and a blood-stained towel that was found near Kimberly's home be tested for DNA.
The blood on the towel did not match Barry or Kimberly. So it was somebody else's blood. The pubic hair, well, when they go to test it, as we find in most cases, they can't find it. They've discarded the evidence. You know, that pivotal piece of evidence that was the only thing tying Barry to this case, that's gone. In 2005, he files for clemency, and the Montana Board of Pardons and Parole denied him. In 2006, they apply again for executive clemency to the governor of Montana, Brian Schweitzer. Typically, clemency is applied for people on death row, but they're shooting for clemency with Barry just because it's a life sentence.
Centurion Ministries, they're involved. They're able to describe and compare the confession to the crime scene, to the theory of what happened. And they said that Barry didn't know what Kimberly was wearing, how her body was actually disposed of. His description of the crime was very hypothetical. It was as if someone was saying, okay, if I did it, I guess I did it this way. So it's not very convincing to them. They also said that the description happened before he confessed the murder. In other words, he already had the details because everyone had those details. Whether they were right or wrong, that was what was being spread around town.
It'd been out in the news even. So we knew that she had been bludgeoned to death with a wrench. That was just public knowledge at that point.
According to Centurion Ministries, Barry said that the second confession that we talked about earlier never even happened. He didn't know that it was going to be in evidence until it was testified to at trial. And his attorney from Louisiana signed an affidavit saying that it never happened in his presence. So even the attorney who the law enforcement officers from the sheriff's office is saying was there during the second confession, he's saying, I wasn't there. In fact, I'm signing something saying I wasn't there. So was this made up? It makes you wonder, right? They go on to say that the prosecutor, Mark Rasko, committed prosecutorial misconduct because he was the state special prosecutor at the trial. After that, went on to become Montana's attorney general and then on to become governor. But at this 84 trial, during his opening and closing statements, he spoke to the jury and he said, this pubic hair that was found on Kimberly's sweater, it matched Barry's. Okay? But what's important about this is the judge had ruled before the trial that it could not be presented as evidence to the jury, and the scientist who made the analysis stating, yeah, it's Barry's hair, never testified. In fact, that scientist, Arnold Melnikoff, later transferred to another job in Washington State, where his hair analyses were widely discredited, and he was later fired after a review found that his work was sloppy and he had been cutting corners.
And just to add to that, hair follicle analysis has been shown to be very pseudosciencey these days. Yet the prosecutor still brings it up in opening and closing statements, totally unchallenged.
And to top all that off, the chain of evidence for that hair was broken, so it couldn't be used as evidence anyways.
And let's go back to his confession. He says that he was in the passenger seat and she was driving. He attacked her. She jumped out on the driver's side. He jumped out on the passenger side. But the evidence dictates that that's not what happened. She was dragged from the truck through the passenger or out the passenger side of the truck. And then you have all the footprints that don't match Barry.
There was a guy driving home from a local bar. His name was Richard Holen. He had said that he saw Kim Neese with other people in the truck she was in. This is when she was driving toward the park. That would seem to support this idea that there were other people with Kim at the time.
And there's so many problems here.
Yeah, if you're looking for cases where the evidence doesn't seem to fit the suspect, this is one of those cases. I mean, you just look at the evidence and you look at the confession. It just doesn't make any sense. Now, Justin, let's go back to 5 a.m. This is the very morning after the murder. So just hours after Kimberly was murdered, there was a call made. And this might shine light on another theory in the case.
There's a woman named Sissy Atkinson. She called Dunn O'Connor, one of the tribal officers, at 5 a.m. This is 2 hours before police were notified about the murder. Sissy tells Dunn, they found Kim's body down by the train bridge. This is before anyone else knew. Now, who is this Sissy woman? Well, she is one of multiple girls at the time that were rumored to have murdered Kimberly. What was their motive? They were jealous. They had issues with her. They didn't like her. It said that Kimberly had actually gone out with one of their boyfriends or baby's daddies at the time, literally the day or night before the murder. So they do have motive. It shows that there probably was multiple assailants here. Between the footprints, you have two shoe prints and one barefoot print. And then you have multiple weapons used. You have Kimberly's defensive wounds showing that she had been attacked from different directions. Now, I understand that an attacker can hit you from all different angles, and if you're defending and turning around and stuff, it can look that way. But how did she know that Kimberly was dead 2 hours before police came across that pickup truck?
That's his claim. When Sissy was asked about this, she denied it. She denied ever calling Dunn. But the strange thing here is, it's not just Dunn's word. Mike Longtree, he lived in the area, and he told multiple people that he was there at the time of the murder, and he told some of them that he witnessed her being killed by some Native American girls, not Berry Beach. Who were these women? Well, the names were Maud Greyhawk, who's also known as Maud Kern, Sissy Atkinson, Joanne Jackson, and Jordis Ferguson. That's four women that were named, none of them Berry Beach. So you have different people stating something else. They also had another woman come forward later saying that she and what her younger brother were out there and had heard some screams.
Yeah, they had heard women screaming and yelling and having an altercation.
The way she described it was there were some girls attacking another girl. But she claims she never came forward because she didn't trust law enforcement.
you have the Native American community here. It's a little dicey with law enforcement. I can understand.
Another thing about Sissy Atkinson is her brother said that she had implicated herself in the death of Kim.
But since Sissy was never on trial and this whole alternative theory was never vetted, we'll never know.
Yeah, it was considered hearsay. We could go through all these different theories, go through these different testimonies given by people later on. But really, I think what stands out to me in this case is the fact that the physical evidence seems to suggest that there were multiple attackers, at least three other people who attacked Kimberly Niece. Yet we don't have any evidence that it was this set of women that were being accused. How do you go anywhere with this case, Justin? They already looked at Barry Beach and said, you're the guy. They got him imprisoned. They can't really go after these other people with this other theory because at least one of them is related to a law enforcement officer.
Maud Greyhawk.
Steve Greyhawk was her father. And it's alleged that he broke into the evidence room.
Yes, the evidence room was broken into the day after all this evidence was collected, and so it was contaminated. It was already contaminated, now it's contaminated again.
It's a double-baked potato of contamination. So you have to realize that these girls were rumored to be involved with Kim's murder. One of them's father happens to be a police officer, and then the evidence room is broken into and the evidence is rifled through, you can kind of connect the dots of why he is the one that's alleged to have done this, although he completely denies it. I saw an interview with him on Dateline, and yeah.
Did he really deny it, or did he just basically say he wanted to punch someone in the face over being accused of doing it?
You're right. He actually didn't deny it. He just said he just wanted to go after whoever alleged he had. I guess that is a form of deflection, isn't it?
I think everyone should think about this case and decide for themselves whether they think Barry Beach did it or not. I don't know how else you can put this. I mean, it's literally everything's been contaminated. They chose to go after a guy 4 years later. He gave a confession, but it was after, 48 to 72 hours of interrogating.
They say the confession he gave was with his lawyer present, but his lawyer wasn't present. None of the physical evidence matches. And even the hair follicle evidence wasn't allowed in court, but the prosecutor found that little loophole, you know, like they do.
Yeah, and it's a loophole because it should not have been allowed. See, what I don't understand is using something that wasn't supposed to be allowed to be used in court, that should have gotten his case thrown out. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong.
I mean, if you let that happen, then why can't you just make up something in the next case and get away with it? Oh, you know what? We have a picture showing Barry Beach attacking Kimberly Niece in the truck.
Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
Yeah, you don't have to produce it either. You just have to say it. So even if you think Barry Beach did this, the process that happened here is pretty disgusting. The Montana Attorney General's office, they're not happy about these clemency requests. And you have to understand the clemency requests that they're trying to get for Barry Beach, they're being supported by other people. And so you would think that would help him out, right? You would think that this is a strong theory, especially since they can't tie any of the physical evidence or forensic evidence to Barry Beach. They're trying to push all this through. Board of Pardons and Parole rejected Barry's claim of innocence in 2007. They don't recommend any kind of pardon or commutation. And they said no proof of innocence or newly discovered evidence of non-guilt was ever presented to them. They also maintained that his confession was not coerced and that he needs to take responsibility and come to grips with his wrongdoing. So again, this guy has no appeals. His clemencies aren't going through. January of 2008, Barry then petitioned the district court for a new trial based on new evidence that wasn't available at the time of his trial. So what's this new evidence, Justin?
essentially, we have all these statements from all these different people in that town of Poplar saying these girls said they murdered Kimberly. You have the witness that heard the screams. You have all these people coming forward and saying, it wasn't Barry, it was this other group, and trying to get the truth out there.
The petition was denied in March of 2008, but the judge did not include analysis of his decision. So the Montana Supreme Court sent it back to a lower court for a hearing. And in December of 2011, a different judge in the lower courts ruled that the new evidence was compelling enough to warrant a new trial. It seemed to me as though he said, I can see what's going on here. They didn't really get him. They had a supposed confession, but come on. So finally, there's someone reasonable speaking up here.
But it just blows me away that this first judge denies it, kicks it down, because the judge didn't put any details in why he denied it. It gets reevaluated. Like,
that's a lucky break.
I mean, this is just ridiculous. Like, is there any science to the legal system here? How does one judge find it one way and another judge find it another? This is why I say you could take some of these more questionable cases, run them through three times, and you're going to have different judges find different evidence inadmissible. You're going to have different judges literally allow things or disallow things. And you could get a different result every time.
Human beings, man. Anyway, because of this decision, Barry is released while he awaits what looks to be a new trial, right?
Yeah.
So he's free and he gets to work. A businessman in Billings, Montana, named James Ziegler, who had met Barry in prison prayer services, said, hey, I'll take custody of you while you're awaiting your trial. We'll get you work. So he starts working as a maintenance manager at a Best Western in Billings, Montana.
Out of prison, he gets a job. He's doing the right thing. Again, he looks like he's a good guy.
He's making friends and he's working hard. May 15th, 2013, the Montana Supreme Court ruled that Barry Beach's new evidence, which is made up of testimony that they say is primarily hearsay, is inconsistent and inconsistent with the evidence presented at Beach's 1994 trial. So it doesn't reliably displace the evidence at said trial, including his confession. So what this means is, yeah, you may have had some fun while you're out, but you're going back to prison because you think you have new evidence, but it's hearsay. He has to surrender himself to the police and go back to serving the rest of his 100-year sentence.
Wow. And I almost wonder, like, if I was in prison and they released me for a brief period of time for a retrial, I mean, I guess that's a nice reprieve, but to have to go back, that's like, I couldn't imagine. That would be the worst hell ever.
2014, Barry files a petition for executive clemency to the governor, who at the time was Steve Bullock. And Bullock basically seemed to be on board with it. He wrote to the board, said, I support the bid, and if the full board recommends clemency, I'll sign it. June 11th, 2014, the board denied recommending him for clemency. At this time, Barry's sentence had been reduced to 52 years based on good behavior. He wouldn't be able to get out until he was 74. Now remember, Barry says he's innocent, so getting out at 74 is not acceptable. Now again, he was 17 at the time of this crime, and you say he's guilty, fine. Well, Barry is saying to the Montana Supreme Court, I need a resentencing hearing, or at least a removal of the parole restriction based on the fact that he was 17 at the time that this crime was committed. Again, 2012 U.S. Supreme Court decision, mitigating factors, does it apply here? Well, May 5th, 2015, Montana Supreme Court denied his petition.
What?
And this is actually something we knew about at the time because Louisiana was one of those states that did not like the Supreme Court decision. And the way that they fought it was to say, okay, guess what? It's not retroactive. It begins the day you made that decision, not before. But before that ever got dealt with, a law went into effect on October 1st, 2015, in Montana, that granted the governor the power to grant clemency even when the board denies it. So at this point, the governor can actually override the board on it. November 20th, 2015, Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, signed an executive order that granted clemency for Barry Beach, and it commuted his sentence to time served and put him on parole for 10 years. This is not a pardon, though, okay? It just means we're releasing him with time served, and he is on parole. And at noon that very day, Barry Beach left the Montana State Prison after serving more than 32 years, and he moved to Billings.
He had a lot of powerful figures on his side, even the former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger, former U.S. Senator Conrad Burns, a former governor. There's a lot of people that were in his corner, a lot of heavy movers. So it's good to have friends in high places. That's the only reason why Barry probably got this clemency.
But I wouldn't say they were friends. I mean, I think what happened was these politicians and these powerful people actually took a look at the case and they were moved by the lack of evidence. And I applaud them for that, because it seems like so often people don't want to take the time and they just say, you were found guilty. I trust that system. It seemed as though they were actually paying attention, which is great. Great for Montana. The only other question I have in this case is, you know, Barry never got to have that other trial to try and prove his innocence, or at least establish that he could not be connected to this crime and therefore get that guilty verdict off of him. I mean, this will follow him to his final days, because he was freed from prison, but he wasn't found to be innocent. Time served. You know, they took mercy upon him because of the facts of the case, but he was found guilty, Justin.
If I was in his shoes and I was granted clemency, I would probably just count my blessings, take my licks, and move on. Because if you do try to get a retrial to prove your innocence, they could find you guilty again.
Yeah, you'd like to think that with all of the facts of this case, that a jury wouldn't be able to find him guilty, but you know, there's no guarantee.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity, that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.